हरे कृष्णा सार्थिमर्जुनस्य आतं कुर्वन् गीतामृतं ददौ लोकत्रयोपकाराय तस्मै कृष्णात्मने नमः। हरे कृष्णा। वेलकम टू अवर भगवद्गीता क्लास। टुडे विल बिगिन विद द भगवद्गीता फ्रॉम स्टार्टिंग फ्रॉम चैप्टर 1 ऑनवर्ड्स एंड अवर गोल विल बी टू ट्राई टू कंप्लीट द भगवद्गीता इन 100 क्लासेस। That will be approximately 7 verses per class, but because the first chapter does not have so much philosophy, we'll go a little faster in the first chapter, and then afterwards we'll go a little more slowly. So let us begin with the first chapter. Before we look at the first chapter, let's have a look at some general principles for understanding the Bhagavad Gita. So these are broad features of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, the Bhagavad Gita is often known as a Yoga Shastra. So, we discussed briefly the position of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, from the Gita Mahatmya point of view. So, let us look at it further. Significance of the Gita is that it is Shruti in the Smriti. So, technically speaking, it can be classified as Smriti. Why Smriti? We discussed in our Ishopanishad classes that there are two categories of Vedic literature, Shruti and Smriti. So the Vedas and the Upanishads, which are a part of the Vedas have four parts, Brahmanas, Aranyakas, Upanishadas and Samhitas. So those are the parts of the Vedas. So those Vedas are considered Shruti. That is sound vibration which is directly received from the Absolute. And Smriti refers to that sound vibration when it is understood, internalized and expressed by the great sages. Shruti is about hearing and transmitting. Smriti is about, after hearing, Smriti, meditating, contemplating, remembering, internalizing, realizing, and then expressing. So, some people consider Smriti to be lower than Shruti, because the Smriti is said to be not the direct revelation of God, but it is the understanding of the Acharyas. Understanding of the sages. That is true in one sense from the technical perspective. But scripture is not just a book of body that is a mere anthology of texts. It's a symphony of revelations that is passed not just through the medium of the texts but also through the medium of the hearts. So scripture is understood through not just the text, but also the examples of those who are living according to text. So therefore, the Smriti is actually in many senses considered more important because there the scriptural wisdom is made accessible, made comprehensible, is made relishable by the realizations of the great sages. So therefore, Smriti is not really lower. In fact, there are scripture statements which also say that without studying the Smriti, Smriti cannot be understood. The education in Shruti is not complete without education in Smriti. So even if we from the technical point of view say that Smriti is lower, but still if we look at the definitional point of view, from the point of view of textual classification, the Bhagavad Gita comes in the Smriti, as it's mentioned over here. It is in the Mahabharat, the Bhishma Parva, the sixth Parva, which is of the Mahabharat. And in that, it is in chapter verse 25 to 42. Now, there are two primary renditions of the Mahabharata, and in some sections of Mahabharata, chapters 23 to 40 also. But the point essentially is that it is 18 chapters from the Mahabharata within the Bhishma Parva. And within the Bhishma Parva, when it is positioned over here, the important point to understand is that from the definitional point of view, the essential definition of Shruti is that which is the word of God. And Krishna himself is God. So Shruti refers to that which is the word of God which is heard by the sages. And Bhagavad Gita is the word of God which is heard by Arjuna, which is heard by Sanjaya, which is heard by Dhritarashtra. So it is also Shruti in that sense. So Shruti within Smriti. So although in the Prasthanatraya, refers to the three pillars of establishing authoritative teachings, Shruti, Smriti and Nyaya. Bhagavata comes under Smriti, that's how the Acharyas explained it. But still the Padma Purana does say that the Bhagavata is the essence of all the Upanishads. And in that sense it is of critical importance for the overall internalization of the message of the scriptures. So now let's look at some further features of the Gita. We see here, we look at statistical features of the Gita. That means, statistical features means from the point of view of how many verses are about what topics. So in the Bhagavad Gita, there are 575 verses that are spoken by Krishna. He is the speaker of the Gita. Shri Bhagavan Vacha. Then there are 83 verses spoken by Arjuna. And most of Arjuna's verses come in chapter 1 and 11. And the remaining verses, all of them, there are just 28 verses in the 12 other chapters. And in some verses, there are no, in some chapters, there are no verses by Arjuna. And Sanjaya speaks 41 verses, which are mostly in chapter 1. And Sanjaya Vacha also comes in 2, 11 and 18. And Dhritarashtra speaks one verse, which begins the Bhagavad Gita. So, in this way, the 700 verses are there. Now, sometimes we say that the Bhagavad Gita is spoken by Krishna, which is true. But now we will see over here, from this numerical point of view, that 125 of these verses are not spoken by Krishna. So then is it correct to say that the Bhagavad Gita is spoken by Krishna? So Baladeva Vidyabhushan analyzes this. And he explains that just as he gives say that by proximity shapes quality. So he says that the essential message of the Gita is the message that Krishna has given. And everything around that is just the context that immediately and powerfully brings out the relevance, the necessity, the importance of that message. So, because Krishna's words are transcendental and the surrounding verses of the Gita, which preface or which succeed Krishna's verses, they provide the context of a proximity to Krishna's words, they also acquire a transcendental characteristic. So, from the technical point of view, they're not remaining 125 verses of the Gita are not spoken by Krishna. But from the overall point of view that they also contribute to the transmission of Krishna's message. So, they are also said to be, in a sense, potent, in a sense, transcendental. So, we consider the recitation of the whole Bhagavad Gita purifying. It is not that when Dhritarashtra vacha, Dhritarashtra was the attached person. So, if I say Dhritarashtra and I recite his verse, I will not become purified. I should only find out which verses I'm going to Sri Bhagavan Vacha. I'll recite only those verses. I'll not recite other verses. No. This is a parochial attitude. This is a short-sighted attitude because we understand that Krishna's words, the purification is not just a recitation. Yes, recitation is extremely important for those who are inclined to do it. And all of us can recite verses for purification. We'll discuss in the 17th chapter how Krishna said this is one of the austerities of speech by which our speech becomes austere and pure. But along with that, Krishna also wants to convey meanings. And the meanings are understood with the context. That's why we consider the recitation of all the verses of Gita purifying. So it is not in a technical sense that Krishna spoke all the 700 verses. But in an overall sense that all the 700 verses contribute to the meaning spoken by, to the essential message spoken by Krishna. The same applies actually to the Srimad Bhagavatam also. It is not that a whole Srimad Bhagavatam was spoken by Shukadeva Goswami. Shukadeva Goswami in fact appears in the second canto, first chapter. Or rather his first words appear in the second canto, first chapter. He appears in the last chapter of the first canto. That is 19th chapter. And then after that, he starts speaking in the next canto. But still, the point is that because it all, what has been spoken earlier, is contributing to the message. So therefore, it is said that the whole Srimad Bhagavatam is spoken by Shukadeva Goswami, sometimes it is said. Now, when Krishna speaks, he covers a wide variety of topics in the Bhagavad Gita. And his purpose is to establish the best sadhya and the best sadhana. The topmost sadhya, the topmost sadhana. Another feature of the Gita is that there are many names which are used to address. And Arjuna is addressed by over 20 other names. And Krishna is addressed by 33 other names. So this indicates, the names indicate various specific significant points. That means the acharyas have explained that in a particular context, when a particular name is used, that context helps us to understand the significance of that name. But beyond that also, overall, the context helps us to, the names indicate the personal nature of the reciprocation. You know, both of them are just temporary manifestations of Brahman. So I am Brahman, you are Brahman, and all names are illusion. Then there is no need for one Brahman to refer to another Brahman by so many different names, which are all basically forms of illusion. And the purpose, especially this will be all the more true when the discussion is based on talking about how to go from illusion to light. Tamasoma Jyotirgama, that is the Upanishadic message. And that is demonstrated in the Bhagavad Gita. Because Arjuna is overwhelmed by illusion and Krishna helps him come out of illusion. So this indicates the personal nature of the relationships even in transcendence. Now, why is the Gita called a Yoga Shastra? So Yoga Shastra, it is often called. Ataha Dvitiyo Adhyayaha. So we say at the beginning of the Gita, and Ataha so and so Adhyayana Yoga Shastra we say. So the word Yoga comes again and again in the Bhagavad Gita. The word Yoga appears 78 times in the Bhagavad Gita and in 15 of the 18 chapters. So only chapters 1, 15 and 17 is the word Bhagavad Gita, not Yoga, not present. And if we look at variants of it, then the Yogi is found 28 times and Yukta is found even more, 49 times. So 78 plus 28 plus 49 becomes 155. So the word appears a huge number of times in the Bhagavad Gita. Now if we consider 155 out of 700, then it is almost, it's more than 20%. So there's more than 20% of the Gita's verses have the word Yoga or its related form. So directly also, by seeing how repeated the word Yoga, repeatedly the word Yoga comes in the Bhagavad Gita, we can understand that it is a book about yoga. And if we look at not just the numerical frequency of the words, but also the essential meaning of the message, then we see that the message is all about yoga. The message is about a connection. Yoga is related with the word yuja. Yuja means to connect. And the whole point is to connect the soul with the super soul. Connect the Atma with the Paramatma. So, and there are, the Bhagavad Gita analyzes various means for this connection, and it ultimately concludes by talking about how the means of bhakti is the best. So it analyzes various forms of yoga and establishes how bhakti yoga is the highest, the best way to connect with Krishna. So when we talk about the Bhagavad Gita, we are talking about a yoga shastra. And if you look at the context also, Arjuna was right next to Krishna. You know, Krishna was a charioteer, Arjuna was the chariot warrior. And the charioteer and the chariot warrior were a team. And they were in the same chariot. So although they were there, they were there together for one mission. So initially there was yoga in their intentions, in their mission. Both of them were there to fight the war. But when Arjuna saw the warriors, when we'll see what happened after that in the first chapter, but basically that perception created a viyoga. There was yoga, but there came viyoga. Viyoga means separation. Separation was not physical, both of them remained in the same chariot. But the viyoga was in terms of emotions, was in terms of conceptions, was in terms of intentions. So Arjuna became overwhelmed by emotions of grief and apprehension about whether I should fight or not. And his conception became largely body-based. And because of that, he lost the clarity of purpose which could have helped him to move forward well. So, this was the Viyoga. And by the words of Krishna to Arjuna, at the end, again Yoga came up. Again Yoga came up means, again both of them became one in intention. It was Karishe Vachanam Tava. That is the conclusion of the Bhagavad Gita from Arjuna's decision point of view. So Krishna concludes his speech in 18.72 and there he asks Arjuna, so has your illusion gone now? Kachideta Shrutam Partha Vekagrena Chetasa Kachidagyana Sammoha Pranashtaste Dhananjaya. So, oh Arjuna, have you heard attentively? Has your illusion been destroyed? Has your doubts gone away now? So, and what does Krishna, Arjuna reply? Yes, he says, Sitosmigata Sandeha Karishe Vachanam Tava. He replies in 73rd verse that yes, I am situated in determination and I'll act as my doubts are gone and I will act, do as you act. So what has happened? The yoga has happened again. So in this way, from the numerical frequency point of view, from the essential message point of view, and from the bracketing context point of view, all these we see that the from all these perspectives we see that the Bhagavad Gita is the book about yoga. It is a yoga shastra. Now, moving forward, let us look at the chapter 1 overview. So here we have 46 verses in the first chapter, and in these 46 verses basically two themes are discussed. For as we see, 1 to 26 verses is observing the armies, and 27th to 46 verses is Arjuna's lamentation. So accordingly, this chapter has been named by different Gita commentators in different ways. So Srila Prabhupada follows one tradition of commentators who focus on the first part, and then the name is Sainya Niriksha Yoga, observing the armies in the battlefield. And the other name, which is used by other side of Acharyas, other side of Gita commentators, is Arjun Vishada Yoga, the yoga of lamentation, the yoga of Arjuna's lamentation. So Arjun Vishada Yoga or Sainya Nirikshana Yoga. Now among both these yogas, the essential point is the same. It is the setting up of the background or the context or the immediate impetus for Krishna to speak his message. Now, in the original Mahabharata, as is written by Vyasadeva, and in the Mahabharata that we get today, the chapters do not have any titles. That's why different chapters are given different titles. In fact, the Mahabharata's nomenclature is also different. And that's why sometimes the same, not only nomenclature, but it's a numerology, how its numbering system is also different. And that's why the same chapters can be referred to by different ways. So it's in this parva, it's in this parva, this chapter, this verse. Or there can be other ways of referring to it also. The Mahabharata is so vast that accessing its message is often complex in terms of references. But the essential point is that Acharyas, depending the various Gita commentators, depending on the focus of their presentation, have named the Bhagavad Gita accordingly. Named the Bhagavad Gita's chapters accordingly. So, among these two, Sainya Niriksha Yoga and Arjuna Vishada Yoga. And we have to clearly understand that when Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita, or Arjuna started speaking, you know, Krishna is not going to say at the end of a particular chapter, Ataha Ekadasho Adhyayaha. He's not going to start a chapter by saying, now I'm going to speak the 11th chapter. Yeah, the Bhagavad Gita is a normal conversation. So it's a live conversation that happens. And then that conversation is contextualized and to create some reference points for categorization. Then the chapter divisions are made by Vyasadeva. And the chapter divisions are subsequently named by the Various Gita commentators according to the focus of their presentation. So, observing the armies in the battlefield, that is the name that Srila Prabhupada chooses for chapter 1. Now we'll see, prepare, now in this there are, in the first 26 verses, we can divide it into three sections. First is this description of the preparations for war, then that's 1 to 13, then 14 to 20 is there are signs of victory for the Pandavas. And then after that, there is Krishna exhibiting his role as Bhakta Vatsala by obeying Arjuna over there. And then after that, 27 to 46 is Arjuna's speech in which Arjuna expresses his vishada, his lamentation. And he gives four reasons why he will not fight. So those reasons are compassion, enjoyment, fear of sinful reactions, and destruction of family traditions. So let us look at each of these one by one when we come to it. But we will begin with the first chapter as first verse. So we will recite the verse briefly, then we will discuss it. Dhritarashtra vacha dharma kshetre kurukshetre samaveta yutsavaha mamakaha pandavaschaiva kimakurvata sanjaya. So Dhritarashtra vacha. So how is the Bhagavad Gita being spoken? The Bhagavad Gita is featuring dialogue at two levels. First is the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, which is not yet begun. But this dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna is a part of a narrative that is told by Sanjaya to Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra is blind, and so he, although the war is there, he doesn't go to fight in the battlefield. And the war is primarily between his sons and the sons of Pandu. So he's eager, because his sons are involved, he's eager, anxious to know what is happening on the battlefield. So he, before the war started, was given the darshan of the Virata Rupa of Krishna. When Krishna came to Hastinapur as a Shanti Dut, as a peace messenger, but was rebuffed and rejected by Duryodhana, and who even Duryodhana even tried to arrest Krishna. At that time, Krishna exhibited the Virat Rupa. And then a spellbinding vision. All the soldiers who had come to attack him fell back in fear and fled. And at that time, Dhritarashtra said, "Please allow me to see." And then Dhritarashtra got the vision at that particular time of Krishna's Virat Rupa. Then after that, that was the only time when Dhritarashtra actually saw with his eyes. So after that, when the war was about to begin, Vyasadeva came. Now Vyasadeva, in a sense, is the grandfather of the Pandavas as well as the Kauravas. It was through Vyasadeva that Dhritarashtra was born. So the lineage is that the Pandavas are the younger generation, the current generation. Dhritarashtra is the older generation. So Dhritarashtra is the older generation. So if we consider the third generation from the Pandavas, the first, second, Pandavas are first, second, third. So above that generation was the Vichitravirya, the Vichitrangada, and there was Bhishma. So these three were in that generation. So Vichitravirya and Chitrangada, they had passed away without begetting any offspring. So therefore, and Bhishma, who was there in that generation, had taken a vow of celibacy. So now, for this dynasty to continue and for the kingdom to have a ruler, a new king had to be was needed. And for that purpose, there was the request by Satyavati to her son before wedlock, that is Vyasadeva. So if you go one generation above, that means it's Pandava generation, above them is the generation of the Dhritarashtra, and above them is the generation of Vichitravirya, Chitrangada, and Bhishma. Now, above them is the generation of Shantanu. So Shantanu, he was attracted to Satyavati, who was a fisherwoman, and through her he begot Vichitrangada and Vichitravirya. Now, before his attraction to Satyavati, you know, he had been attracted to Ganga, and Ganga had been his wife. It's a long story, we're not going into the full story right now. But through Ganga, he got seven wives who Ganga actually sent into the ocean, threw into the river, because they were cursed to have take a birth on the earth, and then the earlier they died, the earlier they could be reinstated in heaven. But the eighth son, when he was born, the son, Shantanu, could not tolerate. And he said, no, don't, how can you be so cruel, how can you kill your own child? And Ganga had taken a pledge from him that, you know, you will not question my actions. If you question my actions, then I will go away. So at that time, because he questioned her actions, he said, yeah, that I will go away and I will take your son with you. But when he's older, I will bring him back to you. So that eighth son who had survived was Bhishma. So now Bhishma had taken a vow of celibacy, and afterwards through Satyavati, he had begotten further sons. But Satyavati, so that means in this fourth generation, you should understand there are different people. There are three people. Satyavati, we have Shantanu, that is the king over here. On one side of Shantanu, we have Satyavati, through whom has begotten various children. Now Satyavati, before her marriage, she was a fisherwoman, so she would also as a boatwoman, her father had asked her to take travelers across and earn piety by that service. So she was taking Parashar Muni, and Parashar Muni saw at that time that it was a very auspicious time and a great soul was meant to appear at that time, and he assured Satyavati that her chastity, her virginity would not be lost, her chastity would not be compromised, but if she became a part of a higher arrangement for the manifestation of a great soul in the world, then she would be blessed. So she agreed, and then through their union, Vyasadeva was born. So Vyasadeva, in that sense, is in the same generation as Bhishma Pitamaha and Vichitrangada Vichirvirya. The same generation in that sense. Of course, because he's a sage, he's considered to be very venerable. And Bhishma Pitama also respects him. So now, because Chitrangada and Vichitravirya had died, so then Vyasadeva united with their wives, and through them he had children born. And the children who were born through those wives were Pandu, Dhritarashtra, and Vidura. So of course, Vidura was born because through a maid servant, because Ambika and Ambalika, they united once with Vyasadeva, because Vyasadeva was an austere sage, and his countenance was not very appealing. In fact, it was a bit frightening. So because of this, after they had, each of them had united once, neither of them wanted to unite a second time. So they put a maid servant over there. So then anyway, the point here is that through this whole complex chain, Vyasadeva is like the father of, is like a father figure. He is in fact the person whose virya has manifested as Dhritarashtra and as Pandu. So he was a well-wisher of Dhritarashtra, and he tried to give good advice to Dhritarashtra to stop from engaging in that fratricidal war. But Dhritarashtra said that, I do not want to fight, but I am unable to stop Duryodhana, and Duryodhana doesn't listen to me. And finally, Vyasadeva, just before the war, he came and said that, you don't have eyes, but this is going to be a defining war, and not just your life, but in the history of the Kuru dynasty, and in fact, world history at large. So, I can give you eyes to see the war. So Dhritarashtra was torn between hoping for the impossible and fearing the inevitable. hoping for the impossible. He's hoping that somehow my side will win, my sons will win. And fearing the inevitable, he knew that Duryodhana was sinful and Duryodhana was doomed. So he said, actually, he started thinking and he started fearing that actually I didn't see my sons throughout my life, and now should I see them dying? He said, better, I don't want to see. Then he said, Then Sanjay, who was the secretary, was given the vision. And Sanjay, although he was on the not on the battlefield directly, he was in the court of Dhritarashtra, still by what Srila Prabhupada called the mystic television, Sanjay was able to see. His vision was projected and he was able to see. And through his transmission, the whole message of the Bhagavad Gita is being given. Now, what do we mean? It's nice sounding, this word, mystic television. But what does it exactly mean? How does it work? Actually, there is much in the universe that science has not been able to figure out. And understanding how complex the universe is brings a sense of humility. So many people say that, oh, this is all impossible, this is all mythological. Now, anything that contradicts the current conceptions of science, that is immediately called as imaginary, as mythological. However, such dismissal of that which is incomprehensible is simply arrogant. And it is completely contrary to the spirit that has led to human progress. Rather than dismissing that which is incomprehensible as impossible, what we try to do is, we try to expand our understanding to bring the impossible within the realms of, to see how the impossible, what seems impossible, could be possible. So actually, the powers of the mind are remarkable. And science is only discovering them now. There are so many powers like that. So for example, there is something called the staring experiment. So these are, what is a staring experiment? Suppose I am sitting here and somebody is behind me and is looking at me. Now I have no, unless there is a mirror in front of me, there is no way I can know if somebody is there behind and looking at me. And now if I am asked, if you sit in front of me and ask me, is somebody there behind you? Whatever I say will be a guesswork. And if it's just a guesswork, then the probability of my coming right is more or less the same as the probability of my coming wrong. There's no real strong probability there of my getting the right answer, whether whatever it is, correct. So somebody looking or somebody not looking. But experiments carried out by researchers in many parts of the world have repeatedly shown that the probability that people get the right answer far more than they get the wrong answer. Intuitively, if somebody is looking at us from behind, we feel somebody looking, we look around. And that person sometimes, we all have that experience. We feel somebody looking, we look in that direction, that person sees the looking person, moves the eyes away. If the person doesn't want to be seen staring at us. So in general, they found that everybody can perceive this more than what would be normally expected. Say the normal percentage would be 50%, and almost everybody can perceive it right more than 50%, 60%, 70%. Some people can get it right even 90%. Now how this exactly happens, it's just not comprehensible within the current conceptions of science, but it happens. So from the spiritual perspective, how this happens is, that the soul, if you consider three layers like that, the soul is here, the soul has spiritual vision that is covered, and the body has physical vision that is functioning through the eyes. But in between is the mind, and the mind also has its senses. The mind also has an eye. Now we refer to it indirectly by the statement, the mind's eye. But that's a figurative representation of something which we see within our mind's eye. But actually the mind also has an eye, in the sense that there is subtle vision that is there. So when we look through the mind's eye, at that time, that means that normally speaking, our vision is through the physical eye. But the mind is much subtler than the gross matter. It is subtle matter. And the mind is not restricted by time and space, the way gross matter is restricted. And that's why the mind can perceive things which are far away, which are not perceivable by the gross eye. So that's how, Actually, Sanjay is able to perceive that which is not visible directly, that which is not easily accessible. Sanjay is able to perceive that. So now there can be special training by yoga sadhana. For example, there is prapti siddhi and there is kind of siddhis by which the mind's power can be tapped. And when the mind's power is tapped, then a person can see things which are at a distance and can even reach and get those things. So, but the point here is, just as the mind can be trained through yoga sadhana to perceive things which are not perceived normally to us, similarly, the mind can be granted that power by the blessing of some great soul. So when a blessing by a great soul is given, that means ultimately it's God's power coming through that pole, then by that the mind's capacity gets expanded. And that is how a person is able to see that which is far away. So there is a science behind this. That science may not exactly be similar to what we call as modern material science today, but and the word science is not monopolized by its modern material version. Science essentially refers to a systematic body of knowledge. And the way the subtle body and the gross body is analyzed in the broad Vedic scriptures is also quite systematic. And it's quite detailed and exhaustive in many ways. So essentially, Sanjay was given that mystic power by which, yes, he had a normal vision. He could see Yudhishthira, he could see Dhritarashtra right in front of him, and he was talking with him. But at the same time, he could also see far away, and in the mind's eye, he could see the battlefield. And actually, what he could see was not just one part of the battlefield, but he could see everything everywhere in the battlefield. That was a remarkable aspect of his vision. So, this is what was happening, and that's how Sanjay was seeing and speaking. So, we were discussing about how Dhritarashtra said, I do not want the vision, but still he wanted to know about the action. So that's why he is now asking Sanjay. And what is he asking? Kim akurvata Sanjaya? What happened over there? What happened? Now, actually this question is a bit peculiar, because he is himself telling that they have all assembled for Yutsavaha. They have all assembled for fighting. Samaveta Yutsavaha. And Nimkima Kurvata. So now, this seems to be a redundant question. After they all assembled for fighting, what happened? So it's like asking, after everybody sat down for prasadam, what happened? Well, the logical answer, after everybody sat down for prasadam, everybody took prasad. So now when somebody asks like this, after everybody sat down for prasadam, what happened? What does it indicate? It indicates that, you know, there is some apprehension that the expected pattern of events may not take place. So Yudhishthira knows that yes, they have assembled there for fighting, and the expected pattern of events would be after they came for fighting, they fought. But his question, after they came for fighting, what happened, indicates that he is doubtful whether he is apprehensive whether the expected pattern of events took place or not. And why might the expected pattern of events not take place? That is indicated in the first line. So normally, when we refer to Sanskrit verses, Gita verses, we can refer to them as A, B, C, D. So the first line of a verse will be A. So Dhritarashtra Vacha, if we have, then Dharma Kshetre, Kurukshetre will be, so it will be 1.1 A. Then Samaveta Yutsavaha will be 1.1 B. And similarly, Mamakaha Pandavaschaiva will be 1.1c. Kimakurvata Sanjay will be 1.1d. So, the question is raised in 1.1d. And the question's strange or paradoxical nature is evident by looking at 1.1b. Yes, why did they assemble? What did they do when they had assembled for fighting? And the strangeness of the question is resolved by looking at 1.1a. So 1.1a is Dharma Kshetre Kurukshetre. And the point here is that the place where they are assembled for fighting is a holy place. It's a pious place. It's a Dharma Kshetra. Now, Dhritarashtra knows that sacred places have certain vibrations over there, and they can affect the mind in different ways. So if we go to a temple is a holy place. What happens is, normally, even ordinary people perceive that by going to a temple, you feel a different atmosphere over there. Now, many people, even people who are not devotees, even people who are materialists, even they feel like the atmosphere of this place is different. Now, most materialistic people, they may not attribute that special presence to the deities. Certain, they say, oh, no, this place is a very nice feel about it. They may say because everything is arranged aesthetically in a particular way. Oh, because the vibrations are there. They say there is some mystical, some presence which is calming, which is healing, which is energizing. So they don't know what it is. Ultimately, it is the presence of God, which is manifested. Either in the God is himself manifested in the past over there to perform some pastimes, or the great sages have invoked the presence of God by their intense austerities. So certain areas in space within this material world where the Lord's presence has manifested or has been invoked, they are considered holy places. So the Kurukshetra is referred to as a holy place in many Vedic scriptures. Actually, right from the Vedas itself, Shruti, in the Shatapad Brahman, the Kurukshetra is referred to in the Madhyandina part of it. It is referred to as very holy places, Kurukshetra Deva Yajnam. And similarly in the Mahabharata also Kurukshetra is referred. And many, many important, very, very defining things have happened in Kurukshetra. So for example, the Parashuram, after he purified the earth of its tyrannical rulers, the exploitative Kshatriyas, then he still felt that I was a Brahmana and I killed the Kshatriyas, so I have become contaminated. Therefore, I must do atonement. And for the sake of atonement, he went to Kurukshetra. And in Samanta Panchak, he performed austerities. And like that, many great people have performed religious activities over there. And therefore, this is a sacred place. So now, Dhritarashtra is afraid that the sacred place will have its influence on the people over there. And he knows that the sacred vibrations will favor those who are pious. And the Pandavas are pious, the Kauravas are impious. So he sees his own sons, because they are impious, he is apprehensive that the place may influence them and they may decide that we will not fight. Okay, let us do some peace deal. Now, although to other people Dhritarashtra has been saying, I don't want the fight. Actually, I'm just not able to convince my son. He's so obstinate. So first of all, politically, Dhritarashtra was the king. And if he had wanted, he could have stopped Duryodhana. When Krishna is departing, when Krishna's attempt to come as Shanti Duta does not succeed, it fails, and he departs. At that time, Dhritarashtra, while seeing how he says, oh Yadava, please do not blame me for this battle because I am helpless. So then Krishna, he turns to Bhishma, Drona and all the elders and he says, oh venerable one, all of you have seen the emperor of the world declaring that he is helpless. So how can the emperor of the world be helpless? So actually that helplessness happens because of attachment. You know, attachment can make the powerful powerless. Attachment makes the powerful powerless. How? Because they have power, but when they are attached to someone or something, then they cannot make right decisions. They just cannot figure out what is right and what is wrong. And whatever that object they are attached to, whatever will be pleasing for that person, that is what they will do. So that's what is demonstrated through Dhritarashtra's example. And Dhritarashtra, he is hoping. On one side, externally he says that actually I cannot stop Duryodhana, although he has the political leave, the power and the position to stop. But emotionally also, he feels, yes, I couldn't become the king, but at least let my son become the king. So he has that attachment. That's why actually he doesn't want the battle to stop. And he's hoping, what will happen? Will the battle stop or will it go on? Samaveta Yudhsavaha. When they assemble for fighting, what will happen? Dharma Kshetre, Kurukshetre. It's a place of Dharma. So Prabhupada explains that he knows in a sense. Now, the word Kshetra can have another meaning. Dharma Kshetra refers literally to Kurukshetra. But Dharma Kshetra also refers to the place where Dharma is cultivated. Kshetra is a field. A field is a place for cultivation. So we can have rice, wheat, other such grains cultivated over there. So this is a place where the grains of Dharma will be cultivated. Now, if it is Dharma Kshetra, if it is a rice field, then rice will be cultivated. And if other things grow over there, they will be weeded out. They are considered weeds to be uprooted and thrown away. So similarly, in a Dharma Kshetra, what will be cultivated will be Dharma. And that which is adharmic, that will be weeds. And the weeds will be uprooted and thrown away. So that is his fear, that my sons may be uprooted. They may be destroyed. And that's why he's asking what happened. And in Mamakaha Pandavaschaiva, this, so 1.1c also reveals something important. It reveals the partisan mindset of Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra, as a king, he's supposed to be equal to all his citizens. As a family elder, he's to be supposed to be equal to all the younger members in the family. But he is thinking, Mamakaha, oh, my sons and the Pandavas, the sons of Pandu. So we see this is a fratricidal conflict, conflict between brothers, cousins. And Dhritarashtra's thinking has also become warped. It has become distorted. And he's thinking of not all the Pandava, all the Kuru dynasty's descendants as one family. He's saying, my party and their party. My sons and Pandava sons, when they assembled, what happened? So actually this is a very meaning-packed verse. And it illustrates this is the verse which begins the Bhagavad Gita. And Kim Akurvata Sanjaya, this will actually be answered in 18.78, last verse. In essence, it will be answered that actually Vaidarbha Krishna and Vaidarbha Arjuna, there will be victory. So let us look at the next verse. So now Sanjaya starts speaking. Sanjaya Vacha Drishtvatu Pandavanikam Yudham Duryodhanastada Acharyam Upasangamya Raja Vachanam Abravid. So Drishtva Tu Pandava Anikam. Now Sanjay is speaking. Now he is referring to Duryodhana. So Duryodhana, what happened? Drishtva. He saw Pandava Anikam Vyudham. So the soldiers of the Pandavas, they are assembled in military phalanxes. Phalanx is the arrangement of the soldiers. Vyudham Duryodhanastada. And he saw it. He was very confident that actually my army is much bigger than theirs. We have 11 Akshahunis, they have only 7. So we are sure to be victorious. He's completely confident. In fact, before the war started, he was so arrogant, so complacent, that he actually sent Shakuni's son, Ulupi, Uluka, so to provoke the Pandavas. And he told how he had insulted every one of them. And he said, see, I have defeated you so many times by insulting you. Now I will defeat you in war also. And the Pandava camp was in outrage when they heard the insults which Duryodhana had uttered out to them. And have them spoken out like that. So he was so confident that he will be so arrogant, complacent that he will be victorious. But now when he actually saw the armies were very competent, very determinedly arranged. So then he felt, oh, it's a serious matter. So Acharya Upasangamya. So he went to Dronacharya. And Raja Vachanam Abravit. He spoke. Now interestingly, the word Raja, who is it referring to over here? Actually, in the Mahabharata, Duryodhana is never referred to as Raja. He is referred to as a prince. Because Dhritarashtra is the king. So now, Sanjay is speaking to the Raja. That is Dhritarashtra. But still he is referring to his son as Raja. Why is that? the word Raja can refer to the word king, and Raja can also refer to one who is very good at Rajaniti, one who is very good at politics, at diplomacy. So, now in the future verses, Duryodhana's diplomatic skills, his political maneuvering will become evident. And because he is competent at the skills of political things, he is referred to here as Raja. Now what Prabhupada does is, Prabhupada explains both. Sanjay said, O king, after looking over the army arranged in military formation by the sons of Pandu, King Duryodhana went to his teacher and spoke the following words. This means he is saying, Prabhupada takes the king to refer to both the prince Duryodhana, who is acting expertly as a politician, and also the father, who is the nominal king. So in this way, both are talked about. That's Prabhupada's rendition of the whole thing. Now let's go to the next words. Pashyaitan Panduputranam Acharya Mahatim Chamum. Pashyaitan Panduputranam Acharya Mahatim Chamum Vyudham Drupadaputrena Tavashishena Dhimata. So, now many of these verses, from verse 3 till almost verse 10, actually these verses are spoken by Duryodhana. But Sanjay, while describing, there is no verse in the Bhagavad Gita which says Duryodhana Vacha. All these verses are spoken by Duryodhana, but that is implied in the previous verse. Vachanam Abravit, he spoke those words. Now what were the words? Pashya, Pashya Etan, please see, Panduputranam, see the sons of Pandu, Acharya Mahatim Jamum, just see what a formidable military formation they have made. And then, now the question may come up, actually before the war started, Bhishma was made the commander. So now if the king is, if the prince is concerned about the safety of his own army, he should go to the commander. But he's not going to the commander, he comes to Dronacharya. Why? Because he wants to point out the weakness of Dronacharya. That's why he comes, Vyudham Drupadaputrena Tavashishena Dhimata. Later on he will say, our army has been arranged well by Bhishma. But our enemy, how are they able to arrange themselves so well? That's because they were in the commander of the opposite army. Although Arjuna was the most formidable warrior, but they had decided that Dushtadyumna would be the commander and Arjuna would be like the advisor for Dushtadyumna. So Dushtadyumna was the person who had been born with the blessing, or his birth had been invoked with the intention that he would be the person who would kill Dronacharya. So because of that, that had been his mission right from the birth. Drupada had been once insulted by Dronacharya. Actually, Drupada had earlier insulted Dronacharya. Dronacharya insulted him back, and Drupada, feeling very mortified, did a yagya by which he asked that he be given a son who will kill Dronacharya. So through the yagya, two people had actually appeared. One was this warrior who just appeared fully clad in armor, and he, as soon as he was born, he's not born as a baby, he appeared from the fire, and when he appeared from the fire, he was already an expert warrior. And that was Dushyudhana. And then a dark complexion beauty appeared, and that was Draupadi. So he was known to have been born with the express intention of killing Dronacharya. But Drona was such a, Drona thought that as a Brahmana, I should give knowledge to everyone. And that's why he gave knowledge even to Drupada's son. Now Duryodhana is pointing, that is a serious mistake that you committed. See now what we are, our enemy has formed their phalanx so formidably that we'll have tough time. So, Drupada Putrena Tava Shishena, because there is enmity between Drupada and Dhritarashtra, by remembering one's enemy, by reminding somebody of that person's enemy, that person's anger is invoked. So Duryodhana is hoping that by invoking the anger of his teacher, Acharya, he'll be able to bring out the ferocity within him to fight. So although Duryodhana has his formidable Dronacharya, Bhishma, Kripa on his side, he's not sure about their commitment. He knows that they have chosen to fight on his side, but he still has doubts whether they will fight wholeheartedly. He knows that they will not, because they did not oppose even Draupadi's disrobing. So he knows that they will not oppose, but they will fight on his side. But how wholeheartedly he will fight, he doesn't know. So instead of just telling them about my cause, he says, just see, your soft-heartedness, your so-called broad-mindedness, what has it done? It brought us to big danger upon us. So now don't be so soft-hearted like that. Fight determinately now. So tavashishena dhimata. So the intelligence which you gave to your enemy's son, now that is being used to fight against us. Now please don't be soft-hearted. Fight wholehearted. That's the implied message of this. Then, atra shura mahe shvasa bhima arjuna samayudhi yudhano viratascha drupadascha maharathaha. Atra shura. Atra means here. Shura mahe shvasa. There are many who are. Asa is Maheshwasa means those who are formidable bowmen, and they are like Bhima Arjuna Samayudhi. So, for Duryodhana, Bhima and Arjuna were the most formidable enemies, and he was almost paranoid about Bhima on one side, whom he felt that he would be able to tackle, and Arjuna, and he was hoping that Karna would tackle him. So, Bhima Arjuna Samayudhi, and what is their nature? He says, Yudhano. He says, so they are the reference point. And the reference says, there are many like them only. They are so formidable. And there are many like them. And he used, Yudhano viratascha and drupadascha maharathaha. So he gives the names of formidable warriors. Now Virat and Drupada, they are elderly. But they have vast experience. And they are also formidable warriors. So he's enlisting the various warriors with whom he will have to contend. And he's saying this. So first of all, the army has been arranged very formidably, and in that army also, along with the formidable arrangement, there are formidable warriors further. That makes things even difficult. So the Dronacharya might say that actually Dushtadyumna is not such a big warrior. Okay, he says, even if Dushtadyumna is not a big warrior, there are many other big warriors, and we have to be worried about them. Then he says further, he gives a list of other warriors. Dushtaketuscha kitana kashirajascha viryaman purjut kunti bhojascha shaibyascha narapungavaha. So sometimes Dushtaketu is confused with Drishtadyumna. They are two different people. So Dushtaketu was actually another warrior who had also fought over there, and there are various warriors. We won't go into the histories of all of them now, because that itself will become a whole separate cause. But essential point is Narapungavaha. They are all kings. They are all formidable warriors. And we'll have to contend with all of them. Yudhamanyuscha vikranta uttamaujascha viryaman saubhadro dropadeyascha sarva eva maharathaha. And sarva eva maharatha. They are all formidable warriors. Yudhamanyu Chavikrant, the mighty Udhavanyu, Uttamauja, Chavirivan. So they are formidable warriors. And then he talks about the Pandava's sons. So Draupadeyascha, this refers to the sons of Draupadi. So each of the five Pandavas, they had got one son from Draupadi. So those five sons are referred to as Draupadeyas. And Arjuna had also married some other wives. So one of them was Subhadra. And through Subhadra, he had begotten one child, and that was Abhimanyu. So now all of them were of the next generation, one generation below Duryodhana. But they were all formidable. So they are given a mention over here. And among them, Abhimanyu was fearsome. And that's why Abhimanyu is given a special reference over here. They are not just referred to as the sons of the five Pandavas, but they are referred to as Draupadeya. And then Abhimanyu is referred to separately as Saubhadreya. Asmakam tu vishishtaye tan nibodhatu jyottama nayaka mama sainyasya sanyartham tan bravimite. Now we start thinking, now whenever the king speaks, at that time people will hear. So although he's not the king, but he's effectively acting like the king over there. Now he is thinking, I wanted to make sure that my warriors are ready to fight. I wanted to trigger, stimulate, inflame the fighting spirit within Dronacharya. But he's thinking, maybe I did something wrong. Maybe if I talk too much about my enemy's powers, instead of becoming invigorated to fight, people may think that I'm afraid. That's why I'm talking about my enemy's powers. Therefore, he says, no, no, people should not think I'm afraid. I'm not afraid. So he starts speaking about his power. And he says, Samyartham Tandramimite, for your information, I will speak Nayaka Mamisainyasya. Who are the leaders? Who are the main movers in my army? And Asmakam to Vishishta. Asmakam in mines. And mine are so great that I'll only speak about Vishishta. I'll only speak about the special people in that. Tan Nibodha Dvijottama. For your information, Dvija Uttama, or best of the Brahmanas. So he wants to show that I respect you, but at the same time, Dvija Uttama, I'll also speak about other great warriors. So in this way, he's trying to both kindle the fighting spirit as well as make sure that their confidence is maintained. So what he discusses in his about his party members, we will discuss in the next class. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Hare Krishna.